Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch, revealing the truth behind the games we play. Coming up in this episode.
One group of people who say that women's sport must be absolutely protected against men. It's an unsolvable problem. I couldn't distance myself further from the identity politics and the nonsense around the politicization of this issue. At that time, the fear was that men would enter women's competitions in order to win them.
Welcome to the Science of Sport. My name is Mike Finch. I'm here with Professor Ross Tucker. And today we're going to be talking about probably the most controversial issue in the world of sport, maybe outside doping, maybe even more controversial than that. And that is the story of sex and gender in sport. And as we sit here doing this podcast, we're awaiting the decision by the Court of Arbitration in Lausanne around the Caster Semenya case against the IAAF. And I know that Ross is very involved in that. But just to give us some context around this case, we're not talking specifically about Caster Semenya today, but what we are talking about is the issues that surround Caster Semenya and how that affects sport going forward. So what we're expecting in the IAAF decision, the Court of Arbitration decision, is something that will not only affect athletics, Ross, but also will affect the world of sport in general.
Yes, and we'll have repercussions for transgender athletes also. So, and one of the points, I think, of this podcast is to try and explain to people what they're actually dealing with, because transgender and DSDs are often bundled together and they're actually different, covered by different regulations, similarly complex, maybe one slightly simpler than the other. But the current, call it social trend for inclusion society-wise, has implications for sports performance and the integrity of women's sport. And that's why this gets controversial, because it divides very quickly into two aggressive camps. There's one group of people who say that women's sport must be absolutely protected against men. And there's another group of people who want to be inclusive. And those two groups are at loggerheads, and there's tremendous tension and aggression. Yeah. And it is ultimately, especially in the case of DSDs, like in the case of Semenya, it's an unsolvable problem.
Yeah. Well, let's just take a slight step back. Don't forget, you can follow us at Science of Sport Podcast. That's the podcast, that's the Twitter handle for the actual podcast we're doing. Ross is at Science of Sport. So you can look that up on Twitter, and I'm Mike Finch SA. So all the links to the stories and some of the stories that will appear on Ross's site, sportscientist.com as well, which you can look up looking at Science of Sport, that will also come up. He'll be giving some detail on some of the podcasts that we're doing. But just have a look, let's have a look very briefly at the sort of timeline around Caster Semenya. And let's use Caster Semenya is almost the example that we're talking about here, because everybody knows the Caster Semenya story. She's probably the most high-profile athlete in this space. In 2009, she won the African Champs as an 18-year-old. She went on to win the World Championships. In March 2010, she was suspended by the IAAF. And Ross, you're saying not necessarily suspended, but basically it was illegal for her to compete because of the supposed high testosterone levels.
Yeah, so anyone who thinks back to 2009 will probably remember this. It was a big deal.
Yeah.
Especially here in South Africa, because it got heavily politicized over and above the complex biology. So basically, this 18-year-old woman goes and wins the 800 in pretty dominant fashion. I remember watching her win a heat of those world championships where she actually tripped and fell after about 250 meters on her hands and knees, and then lost maybe 20 meters, picked herself up, and won the heat. And I thought, well, if you can do that, and sure, it's just a heat, you're going to win this thing handily. And she was. She was completely dominant. And 155.45. And then it was revealed.
As an 18-year-old.
So
it was a big shock, because we hadn't seen a time like that in a long time since the years of Maria Mottola.
Yeah, and speaking frankly, if you look at the list of the top 20 performers in history, she inserted herself onto that list. There's not an athlete on that list who hasn't been accused of something.
Yeah.
Whether it's having a similar medical condition as she has, or whether it was doping in most instances. I reckon 3/4 of those athletes date back to the 1980s and were doping. So an 18-year-old who emerges from nowhere and runs that fast is going to have questions asked. And in her case, because there were subsequently leaks that she'd been quote-unquote gender tested, and we need to discuss exactly what that means because it's an inaccurate word, and we need to unpack what testing means. The media headlines the day after she won was basically dominated by these accusations, and that is where the story actually begins. And I think what happened in response to that at the time was that the IAAF said, our current policy to regulate gender/sex in sport is not fit for purpose. We need to make some changes. And the change that they made in 2010 was they introduced testosterone as the way they were going to regulate it. Because before that, it was genetic, it was physiology, it was your internal medicine, basically. And they basically said, right, let's just make testosterone the target of regulation. And that is where the second phase of this particular story begins.
So then in July 2010, she was reinstated after a number of sort of controversies went through. I think the sad story about when she was suspended is she pitched up at an athletics meet in Stellenbosch here in Cape Town and was able to compete. And it was probably the only time she kind of spoke out about the trauma that she was going through as an athlete by not being allowed to compete in an event she kind of pitched up at. So there was that real emotional link to her and what she was going through as a person.
Yeah, and I didn't know that until you told me that this morning.
Yeah,
I didn't remember it at the time. I remember a lot of other stuff at the time that was actually disastrous. I mean, she was so heavily exploited by people for commercial and political gains. She became a pawn in a game that obviously she wouldn't want to have played. We're not talking about allegations of doping here.
Yeah.
You know, you're not talking about someone who's being criticized for something they did. This is a person being criticized for something they are, which is a pretty big deal. It's like your very existence is under the microscope in a very public way. So that period from 2009 until today must have been unbelievably difficult for her. I can't imagine being in that situation.
Yeah. So in 2010, when she was reinstated, obviously the talk was that she's now taking these tablets and this medication that reduces her testosterone levels. Therefore, she's now allowed to compete. But she goes through a tough time from 2010 to 2011 to 2012. She wins silver at the World Championships and wins Olympic silver as well. So she doesn't do too badly. That gets upgraded, as we'll explain a bit later. But then goes from 2013 to 2015, doesn't have the best of times, doesn't qualify for the World Championships or the Commonwealth Games. And then we get to the point in 2016, 2017, 2018, where in 2018, last year, the IAAF eventually come out with a policy document which then starts dictating what the testosterone levels should be. Then Casta and her team take the IAAF to the Court of Arbitration, and now we await the decision as to whether the IAAF's research and theories behind, not theories, but their proof behind her high testosterone are basically going to be allowed in the world of sport and starting off with athletics. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, that's the
very broad strokes.
The very high level summary of more or less what happened. It's the plot of the movie.
Yeah.
A couple points I'd make about that is, number one is this issue, this controversy didn't start with Caster Semenya. In the minds of most South Africans, and unfortunately many other people, it did, because they were ignorant of it before. And so to them, it all begins in 2009, and then when you're not fully informed, then it starts to look like any one of a number of different isms. Yeah. And I just want to state up front, like, I couldn't distance myself further from the identity politics and the nonsense around the politicization of this issue. For me, as a biologist, a physiologist, I want to consider this as a physiology performance-related argument. I get that other people will want to look at it slightly differently. But for me, it doesn't need to be about any of that.
I'm going to put you on the spot here, because you wrote a piece, I'm not quite sure when it was, somewhere around that time, saying Caster Semenya, man or woman. So you had, in a way, simplified something that was really complex back then. And you said at that time you kind of regret writing that piece.
No, I don't regret writing the piece. I regret the simplicity of my headline.
Yeah.
Because I had to call this article something. And the background to that article was, in late July 2009, she went off to Mauritius at this relatively low-key meeting and runs well under 2 minutes. And I remember waking up and reading that and going like, wow, I figured I knew more or less who was who in the South African running scene. I'd never heard of this 18-year-old. So I wondered what the story was. And I emailed a friend of mine who lived up where she trained. And I said, do you know who she is? And he said, yeah, she's new here, just arrived. But I must tell you, there's some questions about gender.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, well, this is going to be not so good. Let's see what happens. And so I had had subsequently a little bit more information that she'd undergone these tests in Berlin. And when she won that race, I thought, well, I've got this website, as you know. Let me write a piece explaining to people why this is going to be a controversy.
Yeah.
And so that article, I look back at it now, and it's actually biologically pretty good. I'm not unhappy with it. But I called it Caster Semenya male or female.
Yeah.
And in hindsight, that's the whole problem here, is that people want this to be a binary solution. They want to know, is this person male or female? And well, that's the problem, is that biologically they're not.
Yeah.
And so inadvertently, from the very first day, I contributed to the false binary classification that exists. But unfortunately, it has to, because you can't have infinite number of categories in sports. You have to have a men's winner and a women's winner. So people want to put people in one of those two categories. But then once every few thousand, maybe even 100,000, someone doesn't fit.
Yeah.
And no one knows what to do.
Yeah. We have said at the start of the podcast that we're not necessarily going to be focusing on Caster Semenya. So just to give you some background if you're listening, we are using her as the example that everybody knows. But let's talk specifically about 2013, was it, when Maduti Chand, the Indian runner, took the IAAF to the Court of Arbitration around the hyperandrogenism issue. And she was one of those hyperandrogenous athletes. And then as a result of that, the IAAF changed their policy. Just tell us a little bit about what happened there and how does this affect the story around sex and gender within the sport?
Sure, I'll try. But can I give you, and the listeners, like a very quick history lesson that ends with Duty Chand?
Yeah.
In 1936 was the first documented case of a controversy about a man competing as a woman. Okay, now I'm oversimplifying that because it wasn't that, but that's what it was thought to be. Now, 1936 Olympics were in Berlin. That was Hitler's Olympic Games, and there were a couple of controversies. One of them involved a woman running for Poland called Stella Walsh, and she raced against an American called Helen Stevens. And there was a great deal of acrimony between those two, and when Helen Stevens won that gold, beating Walsh, who had won the previous Olympic title, Walsh accused Stevens of being a man, and then Stevens counter-accused Walsh of being a man. And now, at that time, the fear was that men would enter women's competitions in order to win them, which is rather the same as we're dealing with now, and we'll get to that later. Jump forward almost 50 years. Stella Walsh is now relocated to Ohio. She's a very famous citizen. She's very loved in Ohio. They basically give her the keys to the city. One day she's out shopping. She gets accosted by a robber. He pulls a gun and shoots her, and she dies. Because of the circumstances of her death, there has to be an autopsy, and those autopsy results are leaked to the press. And apparently what they reveal is that Stella Walsh has got what are called ambiguous genitalia. In other words, neither obviously male nor female genitals. And that becomes headline news. As a side note, this all happens at the same time John Lennon is shot in New York. So the Ohio newspapers have got half a page dedicated to Stella Walsh and half a page dedicated to John Lennon. It was a big deal back then.
Yeah.
There was no Twitter, no Facebook and so on, so it didn't blow up globally, but it was a big issue.
Yeah. So Stella, was no hashtag.
There was no hashtag Stella the Fella, which, by the way, is what the media called her in 1936 when the accusations began. She was known as Stella the Fella because they thought she was masculine looking and so forth.
Yeah.
So she was the first one. There were a couple of others, and I don't want to give you the detailed history, but all the way through the 1950s, the 1960s, sport was struggling with this issue of how do we protect women's sport integrity? And they came up with various methods. In the beginning, it was impossibly crude and just brutal. Women who competed in these events like Commonwealth or back then Empire State Games, European Championships, literally had to display themselves naked or nude to a panel of doctors who would then certify, yes, you're a woman, go and compete.
And that was just based on physically what they looked
like? That was based on the assumption that you could look at someone and decide that this person was male or female, which I think is probably what most people think is true. And to be fair, is the case in most instances. When you are born, like when your daughters and sons were born, Mike, the doctor said, congratulations, Mr. and Mrs. Finch, it's a boy or it's a girl, because it's a fairly straightforward decision. But it's not always that simple. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's one in 5,000 or one in 20,000 or one in a million, depending on the condition, sometimes it's much more difficult than that. And the doctor says, we'll get back to you, basically. That's the current thing that's often done, is they don't make the identification because they wait to do further testing. So Sport was struggling initially with the issue of men disguising themselves as women in order to cheat. But then it evolved into Sport struggling with the issue of men who were not, of people competing as women even though they were quote unquote male, and they didn't know how to tell them apart.
Yeah.
So they evolved from what were these, they were known as the nude parades, which were obviously, you can imagine the woman must have hated this. You know, you've got to go there and you're a 29-year-old woman, you've been a woman for 29 years and suddenly you've got to go and stand there and be certified by some panel.
I mean, back then was everybody tested whether they were under suspicion or not, or only athletes that were seemingly under suspicion?
No, the only athlete who was ever exempt from that investigation was Princess Anne. In 1976, competed in the equestrian events in Montreal. And she didn't have to do it because she was royal family or something, and someone must have put in a telegram or a call or something.
But I mean, a human rights issue.
Oh, it was a disaster.
That would never happen these days, was it?
It was a disaster. So the reason I'm telling you this is because the controversy now and the accusations that are leveled against authorities are actually nothing new. They're just more sophisticated. Mm. The problem has existed for 50 years, six more, like 80 years if you go all the way back to Berlin. So then came what people thought was a reprieve. They were saved by molecular medicine and molecular biology, because all of a sudden we didn't have to examine you physically, we could examine your genes.
Yeah.
And so, very quick biology lesson, males have got an X and a Y chromosome and females have two X chromosomes. So when you are conceived, your mother gives you an X because she only has an X to give, mm-hmm. and your father either gives you an X or a Y. If he gave you the Y, you're a man. If he gave you an X, you become a woman, usually.
Yeah.
So the premise
seems quite simple, doesn't it?
It seems quite simple, yes. And most of the time it works.
Yeah.
So what happens now in sport is that they say, all right, what we'll do is we'll look for either that second X, the premise being that if you've got two X's, you must be a woman. Or we're going to look for the Y, premise being that if you have the Y, you're a man.
Yeah.
And then it got even more sophisticated. So now instead of looking for the X chromosome or the Y chromosome, they looked for the specific gene on the Y chromosome that was responsible for determining sex. So it got incredibly advanced, but made a lot of mistakes. And the reason it makes a lot of mistakes is because in a number of people, not thousands and thousands, but enough for it to be a problem, you get people who are XX but develop as men because they've had a genetic mutation that means that their X chromosome carries the gene that's normally on the Y.
Yeah.
Or you get someone who's XY and who develops almost entirely as a woman because either the gene doesn't work as it should have, or the gene works. So think of the gene as a light switch. So the switch is flicked, but the lights don't come on because something beyond the switch failed to happen. So in other words, maybe there was a short circuit in the wiring, to use my bad analogy. So the problem was that this idea of categorizing people as men and women based on genetics looked unbelievably attractive to the authorities, but it was super flawed. And there was a very famous case in the 1980s, I think 1983, of a Spanish 400-meter hurdler called Maria Patino, who showed up at a continental championships, I think Europeans that year in Helsinki, and she had left her female passport behind. So this was a document that all female competitors had to have with them at all times. It basically certified that they'd been cleared to compete as females based on their genetics.
Yeah.
She left it behind. She said, no problem, I'll just go get it reissued. And when she went for that test, she failed it. So in other words, she failed the femaleness test. So now that's a disaster because this is a woman who's 20-something years old, mid-20s, never had a reason.
But based on what? Based on this
In her case,
view?
Based on the fact that she didn't have two X chromosomes.
Okay.
So they looked at it was called a Barbody test, where if you had two X chromosomes, you would find this this bar body, and she didn't have it.
Yeah.
So the authority said, well, then in that case, you're not a woman.
Yeah.
Therefore, you're a man. And she said, what? I'm engaged. I've lived for 25, whatever it was, years as a woman. Now you're telling me I was wrong. Everyone was wrong about me.
Yeah.
It's the, so that's the situation that they created. Like, you're going to make that destroys lives. In not just sporting careers, like that's a big problem. So,
well, what it does is it puts that, it makes that decision about men versus women in sport much more difficult because if you were one of the officials back then making sure that there's a genetic difference between somebody, the average person would say, why not just continue to do that? If you're one of those people in that space,
yeah.
Does it actually, it's just unfortunate. I mean, that's always the argument. It is it just unfortunate?
And it is an issue there, and I'm sort of semi-playing devil's advocate here to agree with you. If we weren't so socially sensitive, we would draw a hard line and we'd say XY is men, XX is women.
Yeah.
And we'd say that's the simplest, if imperfect, solution to this problem. So if you are XY genetically, in other words, your chromosomes dictated that you should have been male, but you can't use the outcomes of that Y chromosome, the testosterone and so forth, in a way that makes you male, well, too bad.
Yeah.
You're XY, therefore you were male, chromosomally, you can't compete as a woman. If sport wanted to be super dogmatic and hard about it, they would. But we live in a society where we're trying not to do that. So the irony is that in an attempt to be inclusive, we've created more complexity. And that sort of leads to where we are now. Because
so take us back then to the start of this piece of conversation. Duti Chand, the Indian runner, she was a hyperandrogynous athlete. Just define, first of all, what is a hyperandrogynous condition?
Right. So if we go back to Maria Patino, there's two more steps that have to be taken. Maria Patino was one of a few athletes who'd been falsely identified as being a man, basically, right? And as a result of the social pressures that came on, the authorities eventually decided that they would abandon compulsory testing of all athletes. And so in 1999, a meeting was held in which they decided that that was it. They were no longer going to continue to do this. And so as from the 2000 Olympics, there was no compulsory testing of all female athletes. 96 there was, and they found, I stand corrected, but I think they found 7 athletes out of 3,000 odd female participants had a Y chromosome.
Yeah.
Competing as women, they were all allowed to compete, but they were flagged up by this flawed process. So from 2000 onwards, there's no official testing. But the IAAF kept a policy in place that said that if a situation arose because of an accusation, because of a perception of a man running as a woman for cheating, basically, even though it's never happened. And I mean, nowadays with high definition TVs and the scrutiny on athletes, it's not going to happen again.
Yeah.
But they said that if it happened, this was the process. It was a chromosome test, an internal medicine test, a genetics count, a physician. It was a battery of about 5 or 6 different specialists who would have had to examine these athletes. And that's what would have happened to Semenya in 2009. That obviously blew up horribly now because it happened so publicly and she was roped into it. And so the policy of 2010 was the new version, which now said, right, let's not worry about all these other things, but let's say that testosterone, the male hormone that is responsible for driving most of the differences we see between men and women at puberty. Anyone out there listening who's ever had a boy and a girl as kids will know that up to the age of 10, 11, maybe even 12, they are extremely similar physiologically. And then the miracle or disaster of puberty and adolescence hits, and suddenly they become different human beings. And that is driven in large part, not entirely exclusively, but in large part by testosterone. So muscle mass, facial hair, deepening of the voice, skeleton, the heart, the lungs, pretty much everything you can think of changes testosterone.
A while back, just digressing slightly, is that they say the most efficient athletic body is a 13, 14-year-old girl because they are stronger than most boys in that category, and the boys haven't developed, the testosterone hasn't started building the body for them. So, you know, 13, 14-year-old, that's why we see a lot in athletics, a lot of young girls, very, very good runners, because they're slightly ahead of their male counterparts. Because the male counterparts haven't actually built that muscle yet.
And when you look at school athletics records, you often find that the under 13 and under 15 girls' records are better than the under 17 and 19, because the changes in girls / women's bodies, or girls as they become women, often count against sports performance, whereas the boys just get 8-9% better. And that's testosterone again. So when you look at the...
So it's quite a good example of how, in a very small, well, not a small way, quite a major way, how much of a difference testosterone makes in a male versus female sport in that puberty period.
It's massive. It's like, and we'll have to get on to, does testosterone have a performance effect? Because that is the big issue in the DSD cases and in the transgender athlete cases, which we'll still have to cover. Because up to now, we're talking DSDs, right? So just to clarify, I don't know if I said this earlier.
You better say what a DSD is. Different of sex development.
Differences of sex development, right? Yeah. So that's a grouping of conditions. There's half a dozen, if not more, conditions that fall under the DSD umbrella.
Yeah.
And they are all characterized by the atypical development of sex. So in other words, a person who is genetically XY male, but who develops the phenotype, i.e. physical appearance, of a female, or vice versa. So it does happen the other way, where you get an XX who develops male-like characteristics. And so those are DSDs.
Yeah.
And that's what this IAAF policy covers.
So let's go back to Duty Chan.
Now we've arrived there. And so the policy post-Semenya was, I think they realized they had to fix it. And their solution to this problem was to focus on testosterone.
Yeah.
Now, we know that it's an imperfect way to do it, but the premise was that testosterone is the primary determinant of the performance difference. Therefore, let's regulate the testosterone in order to ensure fair performance.
Yeah.
That's an oversimplified version, but that's what the policy in 2010 was meant to do. So that's this hormone, testosterone. It's an androgen. Androgen literally means male making, andro male, gen creating. And testosterone is the hormone, as we've just said, that is mainly responsible for initiating secondary sex development. So primary sex development refers to the reproductive system, and a lot of that happens in the womb before birth, i.e. the generation of the male genitalia and the internal organs. But secondary sex development is the stuff that happens at puberty, adolescence. And that's the stuff that confers on men performance advantages that are at least 10% in running events. So when you compare Usain Bolt to Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce, when you compare David Rudisha even to the best 800-meter runners for women, when you compare Kipchoge to Paula Radcliffe, that's a 10 to 12% difference.
Yeah.
And that difference has been attributed primarily to the effects of testosterone on the body. So increased muscle mass, reduced fat mass, increased muscle strength, increased heart size, higher VO2 max, and stronger bones primarily.
Okay, so let's kind of define what those things are. There's lots of terms get thrown out when people talk about the Caster Semenya case. And I think if anybody... I think it's not just a case of South Africa, but around the world, every single dinner table has had a conversation about Caster Semenya, probably in South Africa, but anybody involved in sport globally probably have done the same thing. People talk about difference of sex development. You talked about DSDs. You talk about transgender. We talked about hyperandrogenism. We've talked about intersex, which is kind of an old school way of talking about this. Mm. Maybe you can just define each one of those separately. Let's start off with, you've talked a little bit about difference of sex development, but just maybe just redefine it again for us so that people understand what that means in terms of how the average person...
Yeah, so the best way to understand the difference of sex development is to first understand normal sex development.
Mm-hmm.
So normal sex development is that at conception, you're XY or XX. Okay, there are some genetic conditions that are XXY or XYY or X0 and so on. But let's, for the sake of sanity and simplicity, let's exclude those for now because they're not really in the sports conversation.
Yeah.
So you're XY or XX. You and I were XX. Your sister, my sister, were XX. Sorry, rewind. You and I were XY.
Yeah.
Our sisters were XX.
That's right. I should have corrected you on that.
Yeah, my bad.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So what happens then at about 10 weeks is that if there's a Y chromosome, it triggers the formation of testes. In the absence of that Y chromosome and that specific gene, those gonads become ovaries. So now you have males with testes, females with ovaries. The males with testes get an enormous increase in testosterone levels.
As a result of the development of the testes?
Yeah, because the testes are the factories that basically produce the testosterone. Yeah. And so their testosterone levels, even in the womb, are higher than in women. And that testosterone is responsible. It's not just testosterone, by the way. There's a couple of other hormones that are responsible for the development of internal organs of men compared to women. It's more complex than we're putting on, but for the sake of this discussion, I think it'll do.
Yeah.
So that testosterone is responsible, along with some of its family members, a group of androgens, for the development of the male primary sex characteristics, i.e. the external genitalia. In our female counterparts, where that testosterone doesn't exist, they develop the female set of reproductive organs and genitalia. And that's why at birth, the assignment is simple, relatively.
Yeah.
Doctor has one look, he says, male or female, happy days, off you go. It's a boy or a girl. So that's normal sex development. When we talk about DSDs, we're talking about a group of conditions that affect that normal, sequential, anticipated process. So in other words, now you have XY, but for one of half a dozen reasons, you don't develop the male reproductive system. You don't develop the external genitalia of a boy. You develop either ambiguous or largely female genitalia, even though you have testes that are internal.
Yeah.
Even though you have testosterone level that is similar to a boy, you appear at birth to be female, and you will stay in appearance female or part, again, this becomes subjective, largely female, potentially until adolescence. And then things might change because all of a sudden now at adolescence that testosterone level spikes again and you start taking on male characteristics, deepening of the voice, facial hair, muscle size, body fat and so forth. So some of these conditions present initially, everyone says, oh, well, it's a girl. And then by the time they get to adolescence puberty, people say, actually, you know, maybe we've missed this one. And so around in different parts of the world, it's known as different things because of that. It presents later as being male, and they often change their gender at that point.
So without sounding overly simplistic, as with some genetic conditions, gender is on a spectrum to some extent.
Sex is on a spectrum.
Yeah, sex is on a spectrum.
Okay, so actually let's emphasize this at this point. Really important concept. Sex is biology.
Yeah.
Gender is social. And so when we talk about sex, we're talking about the chromosomes, the gonads, i.e. testes versus ovaries. We're talking about the genitalia. We're talking about the secondary sex characteristics, the degree of what's called virilization. How male do you appear? Facial hair, muscle mass, skeleton size. That's a biological set of things. Sex is biology.
Yeah.
Gender, if you go on Facebook, there are 50, 60, 80 options for gender.
Yeah. Because it's how you identify yourself.
Gender is a social construct in terms of how you identify yourself. And people are allowed, and this is a good thing, you know, 30 years ago it may not have been true. 10 years. Heck, for it's probably not true in many countries of the world right now. In fact, it isn't. But for the most part, in a reasonable society, people are allowed to identify as they wish. The question is, and remember in our pilot, we said the key thing in science is you've got to ask the right question.
Yeah.
Is for the purposes of sport, do we compete in categories of gender or do we compete in categories of sex? In other words, when we crown a Usain Bolt and a Shelly-Ann Fraser, when we crown a Roger Federer and Naomi Osaka, are we giving prizes to the best gendered male or female or is it biological sex? And the problem is that people conflate those two.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for sports authorities, they're trying to regulate a biology, and everyone is trying to impose on them agenda.
Because that's why it's such an emotional issue.
Exactly.
Because of that lack of differentiation between those two things.
Exactly. Yeah. So people then get so now we can. And I'm sorry for jumping around, but it's important to understand that these are all interconnected. This is a spider web where you pull on one thread, the web moves on the other side. The transgender issue is where this all
converges. Term we were talking about, transgender.
Yeah. So transgender is defined, and for the purposes of this discussion, let's talk about transgender females. So that's someone who is born and identified as male, grows up, often reaches puberty and adolescence as a man, and early adulthood as a man, and then re-identifies and says, in actual fact, I want to live as a female. Now, that person has got, outside of sport, medical options available, which include surgery, they remove the testes, they can have cosmetic/plastic surgery to create the appearance of being a female. They never change their genes.
Yeah.
They'll always be chromosomally XY male, but they then go on to live as woman. And that happens more and more and more because people have decided, I don't identify with this body that I'm in, yeah, and I'm going to change over. The question for sport is, what do we do with them?
Yeah.
Do we allow that person who in 2017 was male, no questions about it, do we allow them in 2018 or 19 to compete as female? Now, some people say, well, no, of course not. Then they'll be labeled as transphobic because they are telling those people that they can't be what they want to be. And this, yeah, is where the gender thing comes in. It's like, you're not saying, no, we refuse to recognize your rights to identify as a female. We're saying that we are not comfortable with you competing as a female in sport because that's not gender, that's biology. So the big question around transgenders is whether after converting from male to female, they retain some of the male advantage over females, or do they lose it by lowering their testosterone or having their testes removed?
But in that surgery process, they normally do have their testosterone leveled lowered because they want to have those female characteristics, don't they?
Right, and I'm not an expert on transgender, yeah, medicine, so I couldn't tell you what percentage of times that happens.
Yeah.
But let's, for argument's sake, say that in 70% of cases they do. Maybe it's even more. Maybe it's 90%.
Yeah.
The point is it's not true in 10%. So that means 1 in 10 transgender male to female athletes, they still have testes, which means they still have testosterone. And so now the authorities are saying, well, we've got to do something there as well. And the solution to that problem was similar to the DSD issue, is they said we're going to impose a limit on testosterone.
Yeah.
So that's eventually where the two issues converge. Duty Chand, Caster Semenya, and a number of other athletes with DSDs are subject to a regulation that is basically telling them they have to lower their, yeah, testosterone level. And a transgender male to female has the same regulation.
Yeah.
It's subtly different, and they're in quite important ways different because the one is choice and the other one is not. So that makes them quite substantively different.
Transgender, in very simplistic understood terms by the public, is people who have had sex change operations and become different because of their emotional state.
In the majority,
am I simplifying it too much?
No, you're not. But you're applying it to what happens in the majority of cases.
Yeah.
So where this gets really interesting and controversial is that the latest policies by sport don't require sex change. So in other words, the new IOC policy, it's now a couple of years old, but there's another one basically waiting to be printed and, yeah, and released. But I think they're waiting on the Semenya decision because it'll have implications. The new policy is that you don't have to have surgical removal of testes. You don't need to be recognized in law as a female. So you don't have to go through the legal hoops and jump through those hoops. All you need is to lower your testosterone levels.
So in theory, if I went and thought that if I could run a time that would be competitive as a female athlete, as a male, mm-hmm, and I went and surgically or medicinally lowered my testosterone levels down, even though I would look exactly the same, theoretically, I could compete in women's events,
right,
if they tested their testosterone. Is it as simple as that?
It's as simple as that. So you'd need two things. You need a document that certifies that you identify as female.
Yeah.
And then you need to provide a medical record to show that your testosterone levels have been under 10 for 12 months. And that testosterone level of 10 might come down to 5 in the new policy, which was released to the press but hasn't yet come into effect.
That's that 5 nanomoles per litre.
Right. So
that's the IAAF court case that is currently under review by the Court of Arbitration around that. So the challenge from Semenya's team is that that level is not substantiated.
Yes. So with the fine print that the transgender policy at the moment says 10, might become 5.
Yeah.
And then the DSD regulation currently says 5. They apply to different populations. So again, I just want to pull us back here and say,
we're
not talking about Semenya as though she's transgender. She's fighting the DSD regulation. The transgender regulation is basically probably the next one in the queue. Yeah. Because whatever happens out of the Semenya case, and I don't know which way it'll go, the transgender one is probably next in line because someone will challenge that.
Well, there'll have to be some consistency in terms of testosterone levels, won't there? Across all of these different...
Yeah, if it's 5 for one, you'd think it's got to be 5 for the other, unless there's a compelling reason not to make it 5. Yeah. The reason for lowering it, by the way, is that the average woman is at about 1.7. 99% of women are under 3. There are certain medical conditions that women have that elevate it up to potentially 5. But the research that's been done, they reckon that if it's over 5, it's a 1 in 10,000 chance. And that's low enough that 5 becomes the ceiling. So whereas men have testosterone levels upward of 15 into the 20s, sometimes even over 30. So there's a theoretically clear difference between men and women's testosterone levels. And that's why it looks like an attractive way to regulate this issue.
So, I mean, for me as a sort of an outsider looking at the science, you know, it feels, I mean, in a way, quite restrictive to say you can only have a certain level of testosterone. But what you're saying is there is some merit in that argument that if you are above 5, it is a significant advantage.
Well, it could be. This is where we really...
It's a significant difference rather than an advantage.
I bet we've got listeners listening to this and their heads are spinning and they can't keep track of what DSD and transgender is. And I hope that's not the case. But if it is, then welcome to the truth.
Yeah.
Because if this podcast confuses you, then you've understood.
Yeah.
Like, you shouldn't leave this podcast going, it's clear now.
Well, Ross and because I often actually, talk a little bit about when Ross is overseas and there's anything to do with the Caster Semenya issue here in South Africa, I'm always the second person that gets phoned by the TV networks and the radio stations to talk about it. But even for me, as somebody who's very involved in the sport of athletics, it is difficult to identify this. So if your head is spinning, as Ross has said, it is a difficult thing. And just picking up these terms, it may be even a case of even Googling some of these terms and getting an idea of what we're talking about if you're struggling with it. But that's what we're really trying to do here, is trying to break it down so that when the Caster Semenya issue comes up at the dinner table, or whether you're talking amongst friends, or even is an issue with you or anybody close to you, you know what you're talking about. There's not that confusion.
Yeah. So if we were to try and what we've discussed so far, if we try and distill it into one or two sentences, it would be the following. As pertains to DSDs, so Caster Semenya is in this group, but instead of focusing on her, let me talk about all athletes with DSDs, and we know that there are probably in the double figures of them. Yeah. So in 2011, 2013, the IAAF identified 5 or 6, I think it was. We know that there are more than that, and we know that there have been many more going back in the past also. So like these are rare conditions, but they're not 1 in a million. Semenya is not the only one. Dudie Chand was not only the second person. So there's a group of these athletes with DSDs.
And it would make sense, just very briefly, it would make sense that they would be performing in sport and there'd be a high percentage of them in sport purely because they do outperform athletes who have got less of these conditions don't have this condition.
If you believe that the DSD confers a performance advantage, then the overrepresentation would be part of your supporting argument, yes. Okay. And that has come up. So there are research papers out there that are published by the IAAF in which they argue that athletes with DSDs are overrepresented in the athletic population. In other words, per 1,000 people, you'll find more DSDs in an athlete group than you will in a non-athlete group. So that's evidence in support of the IAAF position, and that exists publicly. Yeah. I'm just mindful of this, just to clarify for listeners, is I testified at the court case in February for Semenya's team, and part of being involved there meant like signing these confidentiality statements, which I take very seriously. So I'm not going to talk about anything that was said at that court case until that court case's verdict is fully published.
Yeah.
At that point, we'll know what the courts have decided needs to be redacted and what can be made public, and then I'll gladly comment on the public stuff.
Yeah.
But for now, I'm talking high-level DSDs. And so this is Semenya and many others like her.
Yeah.
The sports authority's argument, and here's my simple thing, right, is that these athletes have got elevated levels of testosterone because of their development biologically. Elevated levels of testosterone give them an advantage that is similar to what a male has over a female athlete. And therefore, for the sake of the fairness of women's sport, these athletes should lower their testosterone. That's basically what the regulation is saying. In a nutshell, you have a difference of sex development. You therefore have high testosterone. You therefore have an advantage that is unfair by virtue of violating a category, male-female, and so we have to intervene to reintroduce fairness. Does that more or less make sense? That's a four-bullet point explanation of what the DSD regulation is doing. The transgender regulation, similar at the end, but what they're saying there is that you were previously biologically male, therefore you had the advantage of high testosterone. After you transition, in order to take that advantage away, we have to reduce your testosterone, and so we are intervening in the same way. So they end on the same point, but they start in different places. Does that?
Yeah.
I hope that clears it up for people.
So I get that one, and I hope listeners do too. That is a very good way of simplifying it. So move on to the things like hyperandrogenism. Where does that sit on this spectrum?
Hyper biologically means high. Mm. So
more than.
Yeah, exactly. Like even not even biologically, hypermarket, big shop. So hyper, high, androgenism, we've discussed what androgens are, male hormones. So these are people who've got elevated male hormones compared to the average. So again, an athlete with a DSD will typically have testosterone levels that are much higher than the average female group. So therefore, they are described as being hyperandrogenism. So the IAAF's policy covers hyperandrogenism in athletes with DSDs.
So that's women athletes who are showing characteristics that are more male than normal female characteristics.
Not necessarily characteristics. And this is actually that's actually a really important question. Because they don't necessarily have the characteristics that you can see. They have the high testosterone level that you can measure. But that doesn't always translate into something that you see. Yeah. So in other words, they can have high testosterone, but they don't use the testosterone. That's why they developed as women, because they're insensitive to it. So another quick biological lesson, sure. Testosterone is like a key that unlocks a door. And in some people, the lock is broken. So the receptor that actually helps that testosterone do its job is malfunctioning or abnormal. And so those people have the key, testosterone, but they don't have the lock, so they can never open the door. So the physiological consequence of that is that they might have very high testosterone levels, just like males do, but they are completely insensitive. And that's a condition called AIS, androgen insensitivity syndrome. And that can be complete or it can be partial. So that creates a massive dilemma, because if it's partial, how partial does it need to be before they're actually female, no advantage, as opposed to male enough to have an advantage?
But do they still display high levels of testosterone if they were tested?
The concentration is extremely high.
So you could have a high level of testosterone but not able to use it.
In fact, probably even higher, because what the body does is it releases this testosterone and then it's kind of monitoring, did it work or not? And it's not working. So then it just pumps out more and more and more. It's like your air conditioner. If you have an air conditioner running on a hot day and you open the door, the air conditioner has to work twice as hard.
Yeah.
So it's pumping out even more cold air because the temperature is not what it should be. So with testosterone, we'd be the same thing. So now what you've got is high testosterone, but they are female because they cannot use it. So it's like that, what's it, mariner's tale, water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's testosterone everywhere, but not a drop can be used. So they have no male characteristics.
Then become flawed, in other words.
Well, that's one of the main contentions, is you're using this testosterone level as a marker without acknowledging that just the presence of it isn't enough. And that's why, like, you and I might have very different testosterone levels but look similar. And someone else who looks like us might have low testosterone levels or twice as high because they use it differently. So there's got to be an aspect of sensitivity to the hormone that determines it. So we talk about virilization, like how virilized is a man? And that basically means how much has his male characteristic developed? And that's a function not only of how much testosterone he has, but how well he's able to use it. So I guarantee you within an athletic population, if I ask you, and I won't ask you to say it out loud, but think of the most manly man you can think of. some rugby player maybe. And you just have this image in your head.
The Rock.
The Rock, for instance. That's now the pinnacle of your subjective assessment of what testosterone does to a man. Then you think about the typical man. There's no guarantee that he's got more testosterone than the typical man at all. But what you can be sure of is that his use of it is greater.
Yeah.
And that's not just level. That's level plus sensitivity. Does that argument make sense? I hope it's clear. So that's why when we look at men's performing athletes, there's no guarantee that Usain Bolt, who has the physiological attributes that make him the fastest human being on earth. So now we've got an objective standard for virilization. His testosterone is not necessarily higher than the slowest guy in that race. Might be the other way around.
Yeah.
So the whole how much does the testosterone level predict performance argument is quite flawed.
Yeah.
Because more complex than just A to B.
Yeah. I mean, in the case of someone like Usain Bolt, there's many other factors that make him a great runner, not just his hormone levels.
Right. So
it's part of it.
Right. So when this debate happens and when the public and the journalists and even well-meaning academics get involved, they mess this up horribly because they use that argument, the fact that Bolt's testosterone might not be as or higher than the guy who comes fifth or 25th, to say that testosterone doesn't matter. And that's a stupid argument. So if I can just explain this, when we compare Bolt to Shelly-Ann Fraser, he runs 9.6, she runs 10.7, 10.8. She is 11% slower than he is. Why? Now, that is primarily because he's male and she's female, and it's primarily because the difference between them is going to be androgens, mainly testosterone, plus a couple of others, but testosterone's like the head, the don of the androgen family, right? The assumption you make is that Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce has all the physiological attributes to be the fastest person in the world. She's got the muscle fiber. She's got the brain. She's got the enzymes. She's got the mitochondria. She's got the tendons. She's got everything it takes to be the fastest human in the world, except she doesn't have testosterone.
Yeah.
That's why she's the fastest woman in the world and he's the fastest man in the world. So this argument of testosterone being sufficient to make you a world-class athlete is flawed.
So what you're saying is in her case, that's not necessarily true. She's not physiologically the same as Usain Bolt, except for testosterone. There's lots of other factors involved in him being...
No, I'm saying that Shelly-Ann Fraser and Usain Bolt are indistinguishable, aside from the fact that
he has... So you are saying testosterone is the difference between those two athletes?
It depends on how you frame the question.
Yeah.
That's where it gets really tricky, right? So this is the debate. So I will read articles written by academics where they say testosterone doesn't make a difference because within men it doesn't predict performance.
Let's just park that for a minute because I want to focus very much on what these terms all mean, and we get onto the performance advantages of the athletes a bit later on. I think that's kind of where we want to go with this, is that how much of an advantage do these conditions give an athlete?
Yeah.
But the final one we wanted to talk about was this sort of broad term of intersex. Now, it's kind of it's almost like an uncool word now, but that's one term that everybody throws around when they talk about the castosemenia issue and this issue around sex and gender within sport. So just tell us a bit about intersex. What does that mean as a broad term?
So you remember you said earlier that, and you correctly picked up, that sex is a spectrum where we have men and women on one side and then a whole bunch of stuff in between. If you think about intersex, it's literally describing a spectrum. In other words, you have... And like, remember your first day at school, the teacher says, all the boys on the right, all the girls on the left. But what happens if you're neither? You're in between the sexes. That's what intersex meant.
Yeah.
And so it was a term that was used to describe the set of conditions. And so basically intersex and DSD are the same thing, with a couple of very subtle nuances, but intersex has been replaced by DSDs because it was deemed to be too crude and potentially offensive to people to cover the complexity of DSDs. So a DSD now, you can describe a 46XY DSD and a 46XX DSD, and you can subdivide it and so forth. Whereas intersex was kind of just an all-encompassing catchment term that community itself rejected. And so in 2006, it might have been before that, but I've read a paper from 2006 where it was proposed, let's do away with intersex and talk instead about DSDs. And then related to intersex with terms like hermaphrodite, pseudo-hermaphrodite. Julius Malema, for those not in the know in South Africa, Julius Malema is one of the more opportunistic, outspoken politicians in South Africa.
He's a very, very left-wing politician here in South Africa.
He's an aggressive speaker. And when the Semenya thing happened, he was quoted in a lot of the media reports back in 2009 as saying there's no such thing as hermaphrodites and she's a woman, blah, blah, blah. So that was where the term hermaphrodite was used in this context.
So just explain hermaphrodite quickly.
So biologically, if a hermaphrodite... This one's fairly quick because we park it, we discuss it, then leave it. Hermaphrodite means you have both male and female gonads at the same time. So that happens a lot in plants. They'll have male and female. In human beings, it's incredibly rare, if borderline non-existent. You don't find people who have testes and ovaries. I was reading articles yesterday preparing for this where it suggested that it can happen, but we're talking about unbelievably rare, and it's
so
not
internally
relevant here.
A person would have ovaries internally and testes on the outside. Physically, they would look male, but internally they'd be female.
Could be both inside.
Okay.
Yeah. Whereas normally, as I said to you, the development is at 10 weeks, you have these what are called undifferentiated gonads, and then they either become testes in the presence of the signal from the Y, or they become ovaries if that signal isn't there. But the scenario that's required for you to develop both ovaries and testes is a completely different thing, and it's not relevant to this. But it was kind of one of those terms. So then you got hermaphrodite, you got pseudo-hermaphrodite, and these were all at various stages deemed to be offensive, pejorative terms, and biologically inaccurate, and so they've been done away with. It then became intersex, and it then became DSDs, which is where it is now.
Just talk us about what you were saying about Julius Malema. He was the commenter. I don't think he actually finished what you were saying. You're talking about there's no such thing as these conditions.
We're
digressing slightly here, but it's always interesting to talk about.
No, but it was a really important illustration at the time of how this debate was going to go, because people brought to the complexity of sex, and I hope the listeners by now, as we said, they've started to realize that actually this isn't just so simple anymore.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden you had all these role players, these public figures who were coming along and saying, Winnie Mandela was another one who said, if you want to know what caste is, just look up her skirt.
Yeah.
Someone else said, just pull down her jeans or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And you'd get statements like, only her mother can know. And I understand that one a little bit better than I understand some of these stupid arguments like look up her skirt kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the point was that you had high profile figures and Malema was one who in many interviews was railing against the IAAF for being racist and sexist and whatnot and just wanting to suppress her talent and so forth. And he rejected the idea that she was a hermaphrodite. And that wasn't helpful because A, it politicized it, and B, it introduces terms like hermaphrodite, and that's not what's in play here.
Yeah.
And it confuses people even more. I mean, this is confusing enough when you're accurate.
Yeah.
Imagine how confusing it could be if we made things up.
So just to give some sort of context, particularly to the Caster Semenya issue, and we in South Africa, and anybody that's followed the case in South Africa, we've seen politicians getting behind it because it is such an emotive. And it's not just a motive because it's a sex and gender thing. It's also a motive because of the history of the country as well.
Mm.
So she's a black woman. She comes from a disadvantaged background. Politically, it's good to support her if you're a politician. And we've seen that happen. And it's very easy for people in very senior positions, even in the world of sport here in South Africa, who have maybe lost sight of the biology and got involved in the emotion. And people that we've even talked about who are high-level professionals who've kind of had to sort of take a step back and say, hang on a minute, let's focus on the biology here and not get so emotionally involved in this process.
Yeah, this is an issue that's just ripe for ideologies.
Yeah.
And because it's high profile and public, it has been capitalized on by many people who are pushing an ideological agenda and are trying to exploit it for the purposes of their identity politics. And I, as I said, I get why that's some people's priority. It's not mine. I couldn't care less, honestly, about that stuff. I see, like, the United Nations subcommittee the other day brought something out in which they complained about the patriarchy and so forth. And it's like, guys, it really. When the Semenya decision comes out, I'll talk more about some of the stuff that's going on there and the specifics. But the point comes back here again, and it's the same thing for DSDs as it is for transgenders. Sports authorities are asking, do individuals here have an unfair advantage?
Yeah.
That's the fundamental question. Now, when is it an unfair advantage? It's an unfair advantage when it challenges the reasons for the separation, right? So the question every single person should start with in terms of performance advantage is, why do we have a separate category for women? Think about it. Like, why do we have to have a women's title in Wimbledon and a men's title?
Yeah.
Why do we have a women's marathon in London that is separate from the men's marathon in London? And the answer is obvious.
Well, let's start with a simple question from a completely outsider's perspective. If you had to take the differences between men and women across all sport, what is the difference between in terms of time and strength? Is it 10%? Is it 20%? Or does it vary depending on the sport? Is there a general rule
I've yet to see one that's less than 10%
in
a measurable sport. So obviously when we talk about tennis and golf and cricket and rugby and hockey, it's very difficult to quantify the performance difference.
Yeah.
But in the quantifiable one, swimming, cycling, running, where you can measure, weightlifting to some extent also, 10% is the minimum. When you get to the throwing events, I mean, you look at throwing events, the women use a discus that weighs half that of the men, and they still throw at the same distance.
Yeah. So, but on the other side of the coin, you sometimes get some very good female long-distance runners and swimmers who are more than capable of mixing it with top men at a different level. So,
yeah, I would argue that that's a selection issue. Like when you talk about these ultra endurance events, I think that if this, you know, the assumption you always make in sport is that it's like versus like.
Yeah.
I don't think that's always true. So then it might distort that a little bit. But the difference between men and women from 100 meters to marathon is between 10 and 12%.
Yeah.
Long jump to high jump to pole vault, it's between 10 and 12%. Throwing events, it's even more. But you can't compare directly because they use different weighted implements. A javelin and a hammer and a discus don't weigh the same, so you can't compare.
Yeah.
But the point is that men have a massive advantage over women at the elite level.
I mean, let's just for an example take the 800 meters, which is Caster Semenya's distance. She's run a best of 155.33.
Yeah, it's 154 something now. She ran last year in Paris or Monaco. So
mid 150s. The men's world record is 141.
Well, she's 14 seconds behind.
Yeah, which in the world of sport is an enormous, enormous difference.
Right. And so a couple of things there. First of all, not many men run 154.
Yeah.
Right, so if you go down to your local university meet or a club meet and so on, very few men run as fast as the fastest woman. The fastest woman is in the top 1% of the world's population, but she's 10% behind the fastest man.
Yeah.
And at the elite level, it is massive. I mean, when you watch Usain Bolt, we keep coming back to Bolt because it's obvious, but let's change that. When you watch Wade Fonikak win the title in Rio in 2016, the guy who came eighth in that final was 2.5-3% behind him. And I promise you, he didn't even look like he was in the same race. 10%.
And nobody remembers him
and
either.
You didn't even see him cross the finish line because by that stage, the camera had followed the winner.
Yeah.
He was that far behind. That's 2%.
Yeah.
10% is a completely different category, literally. It is. And that's why it's there. So the reason women have a separate category is because if they didn't, women would disappear from sport completely at the elite level. You'd still get the woman who comes 650th out of a mass participation rate. You know, maybe the best woman in the Boston Marathon on Monday will finish in the top 600 men. But that's non-existent in the elite elite context. So women's sport exists separately in order to protect women. I don't mean that in a patriarchal way, but to protect the integrity of women's competition. If you did not have women's sport, then with the exception of ski jumping and equestrian events, women would no longer be in elite sport. So that's the start point, right? It's not about racism and sexism and patriarchy. It's about understanding that women have a right to fair competition in their own events.
Yeah.
The question is, and this is where it gets tricky, and where the IAAF, I believe, have made some mistakes, how do you ensure that fairness?
Yeah.
That's the problem.
And what is the level of the advantage?
But you have to do it.
Yeah.
So boxing has categories. I don't know what they are offhand, but there's like, say, 12 Olympic boxing classes. And if I weigh 61.5 and I'm half a kilogram too heavy to fight as a flyweight or whatever it is, that's too bad.
Yeah.
You have, once you draw a line that separates competition into categories, you have to defend that line.
Yeah.
We don't have categories for height in basketball, even though we know that height makes a massive difference. So then it's an interesting, like, why not? Why has no one ever said we need to protect the short guy? Let's have a basketball competition for 6 foot and under. They've never done it. And it's sort of, to some extent, arbitrary.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, physiologically, you just have an advantage if you're tall.
But yes.
It's not the only thing that counts to be a good basketball player, because there are shorter players that are,
right,
good basketball players.
Vastly overrepresented if you're tall. Like in the United States, sure, if you're 7 foot or taller, one in six of you are in the NBA.
Yeah.
That's how common it is.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're 6 foot two, it's one in 100,000, one in a million even. So being tall is obviously an advantage in basketball, yet we haven't decided to protect short people. Paralympics is the other one where there are separations. So you can have different severities of cerebral palsy, for instance, even amputees.
And it's a very confusing space that if you don't know and the different categories. Yeah.
And that's, so Paralympics is most similar to sex in terms of how do you separate, because If you take two athletes with cerebral palsy, now someone's got to decide who's more affected than the other.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're going to try and protect the person who's more affected by putting him in a class of competition where, in theory, he competes against equally affected people. That's what women's sport is trying to do. It's trying to say, here's a group of humans who don't have, at the elite level, the performance benefits of men.
Yeah.
Because they lack androgens. They lack virilization. They lack the secondary sex characteristics like hemoglobin, VO2 max, muscle strength, low body fat. So here's what we'll do is we'll put these humans in a separate category, females, and we'll let them compete. Yeah. And that's great until someone with a DSD comes along or until someone who's transgender comes along, because now we have to figure out how do we protect the line we drew.
Yeah,
that's the problem.
Yeah, so I mean, this is where we kind of wanted. This is the nub of the conversation.
Yeah,
how much of an advantage does an athlete with these conditions have over the average athlete?
Yeah.
And I think, as you've sort of partly explained, it's not just the only thing. So the principal sort of point of conjecture with the IAAF and the Court of Arbitration for Sport, with Caster Semenya, is their research, and this has been quite publicly put out there. Their research doesn't support the fact that her condition alone gives her an unfair advantage. Maybe you could explain a bit about that. You know, how do you, is it advantage politics in a way? Because that's essentially what the case is about. Does she have an advantage or doesn't she?
Right. So on
or
this
an unfair
one,
advantage.
On this one, I can only go so far.
Yeah.
Because when the court decision comes out, then I'll be able, as I said, to see what they've redacted and what they haven't. So what I say in answer to that is what I've written before up to 2017, 2018. It doesn't cover what happened at the court case. Just to be very clear, I'm not telling you what happened, went down there. The Duty Chan decision of 2015 was very clear in that it gave the authorities a mandate to go away and find evidence. It said that they had insufficient evidence at that time, but that they had good reason to want to have a policy. So we're going to give you 2 years to go away and collect your evidence and then come back to us. That's what they did. And the way they did it was they went to the World Championships in 2011 and 13, where they already had the performances and they'd already measured the testosterone, and they tried to link those together. So what they were looking for there was evidence that having high testosterone gave you a performance advantage compared to not having high testosterone. If they found it, they would be able to come back and say, here you go, here's proof that women who have elevated testosterone levels have a performance advantage compared to women who don't. And in their minds, that would have been enough to reinstate their policy. You can challenge that and say, well, people who win sports events obviously have some advantages. So why should testosterone be treated any differently to other advantages? And maybe we can get onto that concept in a moment. But the basic premise was the IAAF was looking for evidence that the testosterone levels improved performance. They didn't find convincing evidence of that. And I remember writing a piece in 2016 in which I looked at that evidence, and I remember writing, it just isn't enough.
Yeah.
Because the advantages they found were extremely small, and they only found those advantages in a handful of events. So in other words, they didn't find that high testosterone was an advantage in a 100, but they did find it in a 400, in an 800, and in a 400 hurdles.
Which in itself is flawed from a completely outsider's perspective.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting, right? Conceptually, it's flawed because the premise is that testosterone is the difference between men and women across all events, but now you find no difference.
Yeah.
So why might that be? The obvious reason that they wouldn't have found that is that when you... Let me give you this analogy. We've already agreed in this podcast, and I'm sure no listener would dispute this, that being tall is an advantage in basketball. Yes?
Yep, even though I'm not a basketball player, but I am tall, yes.
Okay, so that's... So what that means is it's not sufficient to be tall, but it's necessary. Right? Do you agree?
I agree.
So being tall is not enough, but if you want to be a basketballer, you have to have it.
Yeah.
But if we went to the NBA and we ranked all those players from tallest to shortest, and then we ranked them from best to worst in the NBA, those lists would not overlap. In other words, in the NBA, being tall doesn't have a benefit. Same thing if we went to the marathon in London and we said, right, do you agree that VO2 max is an important determinant of endurance performance? VO2 max for listeners is how much oxygen you can use. So it's basically a function of how your heart, your lungs, and your muscles work together to get oxygen into the muscles. VO2 max matters for long distance running, yes?
Yeah.
But if we measured the marathon runners in London and we ranked them from first to 20th at the finish line, and then we ranked them from VO2 max from highest to lowest, those lists would not overlap. So in other words, the point I'm trying to make here, and I hope it's coming across, is that within a small population, a narrow group of people, the thing you're looking for disappears because it's the only thing they all share. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So when we go to the NBA, we already filter out everyone who's not tall. The NBA only has tall people. So therefore, other things start to make a difference.
Yeah.
So now, what's the fundamental flaw in the IAAF research is that they're looking for the difference between women performance as a function of women's testosterone. They're already filtering out the low testosterone as being something that all those women share. So of course they're going to find no difference. They would have found the same thing in men.
Yeah.
If you look for different correlations between men's performance and men's testosterone, you won't find it. Why? Because they all have it. So then other stuff starts to matter. Then your fast twitch fibers, your VO2 max, your running economy, your ability to lose heat depending on which sport you're in, those things start to take over. So the IAAF was never going to find it in that study. And I am somewhat sympathetic because how do you show that an athlete with a DSD has an unfair male advantage? It's impossible because that human being doesn't exist as a man. They only exist as what you have them as a woman. So you can try and lower their testosterone levels, but think about how much else you're changing at the same time. Those medicines have side effects.
Yeah.
And so there is no way that I can see that you can quantify the effect of these conditions, these DSD conditions on performance. And I wrote that in 2016. I was like, the moment the court gave the IAAF that instruction, I remember saying this, I don't know if it was a tweet or an article. I said, those guys should have headed down to the lake and started drinking Swiss wines for the next 2 years because they were given basically an impossible task. And when they came up with the research, and subsequently we've done some analysis of that research and we think it's flawed anyway, but the research just wasn't enough.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not telling you this is my opinion now. I wrote this in 2016. And so eventually their policy comes out. Now it's only covering four events. So it looks discriminatory.
It looks targeted at Kester.
Well, that was the thing.
Yeah.
Like,
that's why it became an emotional thing. Yeah.
Well, how can you have this policy and it only targets her events?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it wasn't targeted at her.
but it seems that way
it looked,
if you're a politician.
And if you weren't following the CAS decision and the mandate they'd given and the IAAF research, it totally looked that way. Yeah. I get it. But it wasn't. The reason it covered only those events is because those were the only events where they were able to find evidence. So they couldn't have gone back to CAS and said, here's our new policy for all events, because they would have been asked, where's the evidence? And they said, well, we don't have it for all events. And the court would have said, well, then see you later. Yeah. So they were somewhat painted into a corner by the CAS decision and then by their own study design.
So I think that, I suppose the final question here, and we don't know the results of the CAS decision on CAS Dasamini, and certainly we'll be doing a podcast on that when that comes out. It's an emotional issue. It's a controversial issue. It's going to be talked about no matter what the decision is by CAS. That this is going to be a decision talked about for years. In your opinion, can it be solved? Can it be solved amicably with all the parties concerned? Is there always going to be something that is, in our lifetime, is going to be something that is going to be continually revisited for the next 100 years in sport?
No, so it can't. There's no solution. There's no. First of all, okay, define solution. There's certainly a way.
Is it always going to be that grey area, or is there going to be if you have that, you're that, and if you have that, you're that? I mean, can it be defined ever properly?
We can't continue to exist in this grey space of like wait and see if there's better evidence that comes along. That's impossible. So, again, I'm not talking specifically now about the Semenya thing, but about DSDs in general. We seem to have been since 2009. Like trying out different regulations. At some point, you have to stop.
Yeah.
You either have to have a regulation that goes unchallenged and goes into effect and compels athletes to lower their testosterone, or you have to have nothing. And you have to say that you just allow these athletes to compete as they're born until such strong evidence comes on that people go, wow, now it's obvious. You know, maybe one day an athlete with a DSD comes along, is a woman, born as a woman, raised as a woman, and runs 20.02 seconds for 200 or 45 seconds for 400, then you'd go, oh, wow, obviously DSDs do have an advantage.
Yeah.
But until that exists, maybe the authorities will just have to say, you know what, this is not a hill worth dying on, and we're going to leave it. So it's not going to stay gray forever, because at some point someone will commit. But the reality is that whatever position is adopted, whether it's to enforce a policy that requires that these athletes, these hyperandrogenic athletes, lower their testosterone, or whether it's the complete elimination of a policy that allows them to compete, someone is going to be unhappy.
Yeah.
So there's no solution that will satisfy all parties. And the current regulation, the one that targets testosterone, that was the attempt at compromise. You know, it was the attempt to say, all right, we don't want you to not compete. We want to allow you to compete, but as long as you meet certain criteria. And meanwhile, all the other athletes were supposed to be happy because their testosterone would be low, so no longer would they have an advantage. So in theory, everyone's kind of happy. That situation can't continue. So you're either going to have a situation when that minority group is extremely unhappy because they have to lower their testosterone and the others are happy, or you're going to have a situation where the minority is happy and the majority is less happy, without there being sufficient evidence, so everyone just has to deal with it. You know, you're basically going to end up telling people, sorry, that's just how it is.
Yeah. It's a very complex subject, and we ask you to weigh in if you want to on our Science of Sport podcast, which is our hashtag, our handle, sorry, on Twitter. You can also follow Ross at Science of Sport and myself, Mike Finch, SA. Just a final word, Ross, from you on this subject. We're still, as we said a few moments ago, awaiting the decision from the Court of Arbitration on CAS Dasamini. We haven't necessarily talked specifically about her, which we will do in that podcast, but just looking at this, in your experience over the last sort of, it's almost a decade now that we've been dealing with the CAS Dasamini issue. Do you find it frustrating when you hear some of the conversation going on around this subject? Because there is so little insight from a lot of people who pretend to be experts, first of all, and the average person who really doesn't understand the issues at stake here.
I don't find frustrating the questions that are asked, because it's clear that people want to understand it and need to understand and that they're enormously confused. So then I'm more than happy to talk about it. What frustrates me is that people who do know distort what they know for the sake of making an ideological argument. That really annoys me. The politicization of the issue is frustrating. The accusations of discrimination that need not be used annoys me. And then on the performance advantage side, people who say, oh, well, testosterone clearly has no benefits for athletes because people with high testosterone don't necessarily win. Or they'll say that having high testosterone is the same as being tall in basketball or having long arms like Michael Phelps in swimming. And like even 3 weeks ago, I read an academic paper written by two scientists who used that exact analogy. They said that Caster Semenya's high testosterone levels or DSD athlete's high testosterone levels is the same as Michael Phelps's long arms. No, not at all.
Yeah.
And like maybe that's one we put in the parking lot and we come back to when the decision comes out, because I very strongly reject that. I think it deliberately muddies the waters of this debate. The debate is unbelievably complicated. I mean, we've discussed it now for easily over an hour, and I hope that we've provided some clarity on the big picture. And maybe when we talk about the specifics as disclosed by the court decision in a couple of weeks, we can further help people understand. But the what looks to me to be deliberate distortion. And when we do the Semenya discussion, I'm going to bring some quotes from articles that academics have written, and I want to read them out and actually have a go at them because they really, really annoy me. They're borderline dishonest.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Ross, for joining us. And we'll listen to you, and we'll have our next podcast up in a couple of weeks' time. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.